Yo, what is going down, Energy fam? Welcome back, slash, welcome to the next episode of Primal Alchemy's Red Pill Initiation Hour, here with your host, Chris Story. First things first, guys, a little bit of housekeeping to undertake before we can kick shit off with today's episode. I just want to give my love and gratitude to each and every one of you who continues to tune episode after episode, giving me a little bit of time of your day to empower yourself, awaken yourself, save yourself, and in the process, save the world. Please drop me a review or a little bit of feedback if you can, guys, on iTunes, Spotify, Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, YouTube. It really does mean a lot to me, guys, not just out, but also so for the cast. The more engagement I get, the more exposure and visibility I can return, which means I get to deliver this message to a larger number of people, which is what I'm trying to do. And I can't do that without you. So please, if you enjoy this episode, reach out to me and let me know what you think. It will be massively, massively, massively appreciated. And in return, I always drop guys an exclusive discount code. That's the code REDPILL. That's the code REDPILL. That when used at checkout, primalalchemy.co.uk, you'll get 10% off anything within your shopping basket at the time of purchase. Guys, I also have another update for you with where I'm currently at with expanding the Primal Alchemy brand into phase 2. So at the time of recording this, it is currently Monday 2nd of September. You're probably hearing this in like 3 days time or so, maybe more, who knows. Anyway, the point being is I hope to get all of the new products and services that we will be offering through Primal Alchemy updated on the website, hopefully by the first week of October. And then phase 2 will be 100% initiated, and it's time to change motherfucking planet. So really looking forward to that, guys. So I do apologize for my lack of consistency with these podcast releases over the past few months. But it's all for the greater good, guys. Honestly, phase is going to be amazing. Cannot wait to share it with you. And the world, honestly, that take shit to the next level. But, putting that aside, moving on to today's episode, we have Mr. Richard Cassaro. Richard is a specialist on esoteric symbolism. He's an author, he's LO Freemasonic Brethren, and overall, a fucking gatekeeper of a lot of esotericism. I've been really looking forward to this episode, guys. Looking forward to it enough, in fact, to actually bring this episode forward a little bit. So I'm releasing this. This is episode 56, but it was actually somewhere in the 70s when I recorded it. But I really wanted you guys to experience this because Richard doesn't have as many appearance as you would think someone with his knowledge to have on podcast. He's on some net level. He is, or I should say, holding metaphysically and metaphorically the flame of initiated knowledge, and I'm helping shine that, and you know, get this message out there to all of the truth seekers that are looking for looking proof that our ancient ancestors encoded within stone in their texts. Within their religions, their mythologies, Richard is the man for deciphering this and then delivering the teachings to you in the most digestible, accessible way. And this is one of those rare podcasts of mine that if you are currently listening to, although you can, and I'm not saying that you can't, although you can perfectly in this podcast listening to it, you will get much greater benefit if you are to watch this podcast. This is a special episode in that Richard was kind enough to send me over his fucking wealth, his whole wealth of research that has been undertaken through his career. And we go through it bit by bit, We share a screen on the recording, and we just talk through it. We talk through all his research, and you get and actually see like a live reputation of what we're talking about, and it makes it a lot easier to understand, because when you're dealing with symbolism, it's good to be see the symbol, you know, instead of just talking about the symbolic metaphor analogies of that symbol. You want to see it so you get an idea of where we're coming from. But again, if you can only listen to this, you're still going to gain a lot from it. But if you can check out the video version, you will not be disappointed. And as always, guys, we will massively appreciate if after you listen to this to reach out to myself or Richard. Richard's contact details will be posted in the side notes, in the show notes below. And I hope you really enjoy, guys, just as much as I did. So please enjoy, as always. Morphs, tell these fools what's up.
You take the blue pill, the story ends. You wake up in your bed and believe whatever you want to believe. You take the red pill, you stay in Wonderland, and I show you how deep the rabbit hole goes.
As above, so below, what lies without resides within. Time for growth to begin. Mental, physical, and spiritual, we find balance with all three as we focus on totality, the whole, not the half. This is for those on a spiritual path, looking for the clues to the answers of life. But the truth ain't always nice, so leave your ego at the door. Let your inner lion roar and your spirit soar as we go deep down to the molecular level. Tap into the body with some yogic breath. Throw in some calisthenics for a true strength test. Like the shamans of old, we use nature to heal with a little bit of DMT to reveal. This whole life journey is a little surreal, and your mind needs a leader, not a follower in life. Let your mind be the master and you pay a hefty price. This next 60 minutes is about self-mastery. It's not an easy path and it's a lifelong journey, but we up to empower with this red pill initiation hour. With this red pill initiation hour, brought to you by Primal Alchemy.
The Matrix is the world that has been pulled over your eyes to blind you from the truth.
Three, two, one, and oh shit. Praise Osiris. Guys, we are back with episode 56 of the Red Pill Initiation Hour. And going off a lot of feedback from you guys in terms of what you are interested in, I've been looking forward to this for a long time, guys. This episode is going to be a special one. We're going to mix things up a little bit, as well as it being just as rewarding listening to this. This episode is going to be one where you're really going to find the merit in it through watching it, as we're going to be experimenting with a screen share so we can overlook the research at hand and have some visuals to really help solidify the message in your mind about what we're discussing here. So yeah, you guys know the deal by now. You know how I always go on about there being an ancient, long-lost civilization and how this civilization left their fingerprints around the world, around the globe, through different pieces of architecture, through different mythologies. And over time, we have forgotten. We've forgotten our past. And it's up to us to fulfill this prophecy that was put in place, to remember who we are and make sure that our ancestors' work didn't go to waste. And today's guest is someone who I've looked up to for a long time, guys. I'm going back to when I was first initiated into Freemasonry when I was about 18. I was brought to the attention of this work, and yeah, right from the get-go, it just resonated with me. Like, you know, when you hear something for the first time and you don't even have to have any background knowledge on it, and something just seems like it clicks inside of you. This is exactly what the information we're going over today did to me, which led me to really create the message that you guys hear me talk about throughout the previous podcast episodes.
So today's guest is Mr. Richard Cassaro. Now, Richard is an independent researcher, also a fellow Masonic brethren, and he is the real-life Indiana Jones. He has done everything that I am hoping to fulfill in my life, which is to go to these ancient sites to decode and decipher the message that is, as titled in one of Richard's books, Written in Stone. And as I've explained before, these messages were encoded into these monuments so that initiates of the future who had the eyes to see and the ears to hear would see the message loud and clear, and we would be able to then allow this knowledge to resurface, and in order to deliver it to the next generation of initiates in this world, in order to bring us back into the golden age. So yes, let's get shit started. I just want to jump straight into this. So Richard, thanks for coming on, man. This really does mean a lot.
Oh, Chris, thank you so much. That was a wonderful introduction and spot on, too, in terms of what I'm trying to do and the research that I'm engaged in and the books I'm publishing and everything. So I really appreciate it. And it's a pleasure to be with you and your audience.
Yeah, no problem, Rich. No problem. And honestly, like, we've been trying to make this work for a while now. I remember that I must have reached out to you back in like maybe September, October, and then we were trying to get it to the beginning of the year, and then it was like April, and now we've just finally, this, as always, just the stars do align if you just keep pursuing something. And yeah, finally got you on. And obviously, Rich, like I've said, I'm a big fan of your work, and I've put a few hours into studying everything that you've done in your career. But for everyone who's not familiar with your work, or this is their first time in being introduced to yourself, could you give us a little bit of background information on who you are and how you really started to walk this path that you currently find yourself on?
Sure. Yeah, I've always been interested in ancient cultures in general. I've also been interested in mysteries. And ever since I was a very small child, one of the things that really grabbed my attention was the idea of pyramids around the world. And we're talking, you know, the 70s, the early 80s, long before the internet and that type of stuff. I was very well aware that there were pyramids in Mexico, pyramids in Egypt and other parts of the world. And I saw that as a mystery, and I knew it was a mystery at the time. And so for me, that just always grabbed me. It always made me sort of feel like there was something special there. There was something mysterious. There was some enigma, some puzzle about there being these strange geometric structures built in stone, created by different cultures that are supposedly unrelated. And as I got older and was, you know, college age and after college, I decided I wanted to become an Egyptologist. So I started to take classes in Egyptology. And I was very turned off by the professors, and they were very turned off by my ideas of comparative religion and trying to trace and look for connections among civilizations that far, far flung civilizations across the Atlantic Ocean, across the Pacific Ocean. This was an idea that was very popular with the Victorian era scholars and before, but starting in the early 20th century, it really lost momentum. And in the past several decades, the idea has become taboo in academia. And so my interest grew because I was, by the time I was maybe 25 years old, I guess this is the mid-90s, I was sure that there were connections. I had already done a tremendous amount of research and travel, and I felt like I was onto something big. And I wanted to continue the work of the Victorian era scholars because I found their work to be impeccable. I've still to this day think that they're much smarter than modern scholars. I think we're in the era of specialization. And so there's nobody really, well, there are a few modern authors like Graham Hancock, who's done a wonderful job coming around and saying, you know, look at all these similarities around the world. Is there a connection? And of course, he's just pointing to the same idea of the Victorian era scholars. Was there a connection? And the main idea here is, could there be a lost civilization? Could the story of humanity be much older than it really is? And the Victorians thought that the lost civilization was Atlantis. And there's a lot of evidence to believe that it was Atlantis. I don't necessarily say Atlantis in my book. I think there's a tremendous amount of evidence for it, but I'm more interested in showing the similarities among cultures rather than trying to find a submerged continent. It could have been Atlantis. It might not have been Atlantis. It might have been something else. But whatever it was, there was an earlier civilization, and it was very highly advanced. I don't think it was mechanically highly advanced. I don't think they had a tremendous high technology that we have today. I think they were spiritually more advanced, and there's a lot of evidence in ancient cultures that proves that. And one of the things that I do in my research that's novel, I think, is that what I try to do is show how modern secret societies like the Freemasons, the Odd Fellows, the Knights of Pythias, and so on, Shriners, even the collegiate secret societies like the Skull and Bones and Book and Snake and at Yale University, they really inherited a lot of this ancient wisdom. And you see it in their architecture, you see it in their signs and symbols. And that's something else that I bring to this research. I try to show how this ancient wisdom, there was an ancient shared wisdom around the world. Ancient cultures like the cultures in China, the cultures in Southeast Asia, India, in Europe, in the Americas, Inca, pre-Inca culture, in Mesoamerica, we have the Maya, the Olmec, the Aztec, etc., the Toltec. Even in North America, the Mississippian cultures, they all really had the same wisdom tradition. They shared the same symbols and in many cases the same architecture. And so I believe they all had what I call the same universal religion. And this is really what I'm interested in. I'm not as interested in trying to find the lost civilization. I'm more interested in trying to decipher these symbols, find out what they mean, and see if we can revive some of this ancient spiritual wisdom in modern times so that we could live more fulfilling and rewarding lives. How's that? Is that good?
That's pretty good, man. I think you would have sold me if I haven't heard of your work before. So... yeah, Richard, let's jump into this. So, guys, this is my first time doing a recording like this with a screen share. So if it fucks up, I'm sorry, but I'm pretty sure we've got this shit on lockdown. Me and Rich did a little bit of a trial run before we officially kicked this off. So, yeah, Rich, where do you want to start, mate? Do you want to sort of... Where can we just jump in with this? Should I just pull up like some pictures and then we just start discussing it?
Yeah, that's good. Yeah, like the first one that you have here, this is an example. You know, we have the map in the middle with the Atlantic Ocean. The old world is really the cultures of the old world before the discovery of the Americas, supposedly in 1492 by Christopher Columbus, right? Mm-hmm. We have the new world on the left, the old world on the right. And what started to happen was after the discovery of the New World, archaeologists started to recognize parallels to the Old World. They noticed the same pyramids. They noticed the same corbel vault arches, which is the photo you see there in the middle section. Those are called corbelled arches. And on the bottom is mummification. And so they started to wonder, I mean, how are these parallels possible? Since ancient cultures, they believed, weren't able to cross the Atlantic Ocean, since Christopher Columbus supposedly was the first to cross the Atlantic. Mm-hmm. And so that's really when the mystery began, when these archaeologists started digging up these New World cultures. For example, the Inca and pre-Inca cultures in Peru and the Maya and Olmec and Toltec cultures in Mexico. They started to see these parallels and they started to wonder, how is this possible? And this is obviously before the era of UFOs, right? So people started to say, well, we have this ancient story from Plato of Atlantis, and that story was never quite fully dead. I mean, you know, it's a classic story, and people were, over the centuries, always thinking about it and always referring to it. And the idea was that Plato wrote in his Critias essay that there was this ancient continent in the middle of the Atlantic Ocean, Atlantis. That's where the Atlantic Ocean gets its name. And this civilization was destroyed in a catastrophe, and survivors fled to both sides of the Atlantic Ocean, bringing their spiritual wisdom and religion with them. So this was the idea of the archaeologists. This was their theory, their working theory of history. Exactly. Yeah. Good shot right there. We have the Atlantis island, the supposed Atlantis island, where it was before it was submerged between the waves. And the survivors there, indicated by the red arrows, fleeing to both the old world and the new world. And that was the, I guess you would say, one of the key models of history up until probably the early 20th century. And that's when a lot of scholars started to doubt it, because no actual evidence of a geographic location called Atlantis. And there was no evidence of a submerged island in the middle of the Atlantic Ocean. And of course, we know now there wouldn't be, because of all the different changes that occur, geologically speaking, in a very short amount of time, you have major changes. So if there was an Atlantis island, I'm not surprised that there wouldn't be, that there would no longer be any evidence for it physically in the middle of the Atlantic Ocean. And besides, I don't think the theory of an advanced civilization necessarily rests on the actual finding of a submerged continent in the middle of the Atlantic Ocean. The reason I point this Atlantis story out is because I find it fascinating, and because I think it's an example of what may have occurred and what may have caused these parallels among old and new world cultures.
I'm just looking at this so this image we've got up now, and yeah, just to expand on everything you were saying, Rich, it was obviously our first known account of Atlantis being brought to the people was obviously through Plato and his text of Critias, and he said that it came from Solon, who was like the great lawmaker and philosopher of ancient Greece, and he went out to Egypt and studied with the priests and was initiated into their mystery religion, and they told him of this great advanced civilization that had lived in an island that was west of the Pillars of Hercules. So the Pillars of Hercules are going to be the Straits of Gibraltar now, and west of, I'm just looking at
That's
this
it.
Image.
No, you
yeah,
got
yeah,
it.
Yeah,
the spot on.
You yeah, west it. Of the Pillars of Hercules, it sank about 9,000 years before that time. And then Solon told that to the grandfather of Critias, and then Critias then supposedly told Plato. I think that's how it went. That may be a few little details there butchered, but as far as I'm aware, what it was, another thing that was brought up is that it was the Atlanteans' last stand, in that they were trying to evade Athens, and the Athenians managed to stop them from conquering Greece, and then from there it just went downhill very quickly for the Atlanteans. And not only did they fuck up and not manage to win the war, they also got wiped out in the process. But then this is directly related to Randall Carlson and a lot of the stuff that Graham Hancock refers to with this Younger Dryas impact, which then was kind of like the epicenter, which Crete, when like the actual reason for it being sank was due to this meteorite impact in the North American continent. So it's very interesting looking at old maps, looking at ancient maps of the ancient world, and how they, what their maps looked like back in the day. 'Cause there's a lot of interesting shit that's just like, we don't really know about it in today, unless you actually look and study ancient maps, that there's land masses that just appear and disappear. Like, this might be a little bit irrelevant for everyone else who's not in the UK, but the UK itself, there was supposedly an island off the coast of Ireland called High Brazil, which is supposedly was like one of the mainlands for Druids and was home to another advanced civilization. But that's obviously, as the sea levels have changed over time, has taken that off the map. So just having a little look, what are we on to now? So this is the steep pyramids and the stone circle.
Yeah, this is just a quick background. These photos that I'm showing here, many of them originally appeared in my books. And so what I did was, just to advertise my books, I have a website, richardcassaro.com, where I started to sort of post blog posts and articles with little pieces from my books, extracts from my books, and I used the photos there originally. I also used these photos in my videos, and later on I used them in my social media posts. So that's where these photos came from. And this is one of them. It's called Memories of the Golden Age, Step Pyramids and Stone Serpents on Both Sides of the Atlantic/Atlantis. Mm. Probably should have put a question mark by Atlantis, but you get the idea. You know, it's not just that we have these step pyramids on both sides of the Atlantic Ocean. It's that we have these stone serpents within a stone's throw of these step pyramids. So that kind of adds an extra layer of, you know, disbelief. You know, that's pretty strange how, you know, we don't just have the pyramids, we have the stone serpents. And I get into my book exactly what the serpents symbolize, in my opinion, and according to research of past scholars, it has to do with this kind of spiritual death and resurrection that we all need to go through in order to reach the state of the higher self, the cosmic man, the Atman, which is who we are inside. You know, the ancient wisdom tradition, basically around the world, it's still preserved in Hinduism and in some respects Buddhism, but the ancient wisdom tradition teaches that we are eternal beings having a material existence, and that's just the long and short of it. And that's what the core of this universal religion teaches. And very quickly, the reason I call it a golden age, again, getting back to Plato in his Critias essay, what he says destroyed Atlantis was a gradual degradation of the morality of the peoples of Atlantis. Mm-hmm. And I think that this is a key aspect of the Atlantis story that I haven't seen any other researchers kind of focus in on. In Critias itself, he says, and I'm quoting here, he says, "When the divine element in them, in the Atlanteans, became weakened and their human traits became predominant, they ceased to be able to carry their prosperity with moderation." Mm. And essentially what he's saying is they became morally, slowly but surely, they became morally immoral. They lost sight of the true self inside. They ceased to be able to carry their prosperity with moderation because when the divine element in them became weakened, and their human traits became predominant. If you read between the lines there, he's basically telling you that they had a very strong divine element. They were in touch with their higher selves. Mm-hmm. And that's why at the beginning when I said I don't believe they were a technologically advanced civilization, I believe they were a spiritually advanced civilization. There's evidence of that in Plato, and that's the line that I just read. And I believe that these children cultures, these cultures on both sides of the Atlantic, I don't believe they were direct descendants of Atlantis. I don't believe, when we look at the Maya culture, for example, on the left, or the Egyptian culture on the right, I don't think we're seeing the children of Atlantis. I think we're seeing the great, great, great grandchildren of Atlantis. Yeah. And that's an important point to make, because I think by the time it got to the Maya on the left and the Egyptian on the right, they had so profoundly lost sight of the ancient true teaching that it was almost completely diluted in both sides, but still visible and still recognizable, and compared to us, still strong, because we live in a completely bankrupt civilization, in my opinion. I mean, the earth is beautiful. It's a great place, and nature is wonderful, and so on and so forth. But what we've done in our modern civilizations is just, we've fallen to a great extent. I think the Maya here on the left and the Egyptians on the right, they are an example of a fallen, they had fallen one level from the Atlanteans, or several levels from the Atlanteans. Or
and we've
from
fallen even more.
Right. Or from whatever earlier civilization they learned their wisdom from. And we've fallen even more. I mean, way more. So, and that I think you can read in the Plato story, and you can also see it, and this is again why I call it Memories of the Golden Age, in other parts of the world, in Europe, for example, the Romans and the Greeks talked about having the Golden Age. They said that there were four ages. There was the Golden Age, the Silver Age, the Bronze Age, and the Iron Age. And that matches up to different other cultures. For example, the Hindus, I'm sure you know, they had the Yuga cycles, and they talked about the very same thing. There was the Satya Yuga, which was the Golden Age, the Treta Yuga, which is the Silver Age, the Dwapara Yuga, which is the Bronze Age, and the Kali Yuga, which is supposedly the age that we're living in now. I believe it's the age we're living in now. Mm-hmm. So back the earlier, the reason why the most ancient cultures are the most advanced is because they were closer to the Golden Age. And yeah. as the ages passed, we've fallen from the golden to the silver, down to the bronze, and now we're in the worst age of all, which is the Iron Age. And I think it's easy to see that.
Yeah, and this is one of the things that I explain in a slightly different manner than yourself, Richard, but it hits on the same points, is that just as we as humans have our circadian rhythms, which is essentially a sleep-wake cycle, the Earth, if you scale that up, has its sleep-wake cycle. Sleep obviously being autumn and winter.
Beautiful.
The wake being the spring and summer. And then if we scale that up again, we get into the precessional ages. And the precessional ages, when we correlate that to the sinking of Atlantis or any cataclysmic events, it all times very nicely to this cycle, which is a 25,920 year cycle. And if we look where we are on that cycle, we are directly now opposite the point in time which was the end of Atlantis. And essentially what we entered at the end of Atlantis was winter, the great sleep. And for the next 12,000 years, we have fallen into the material realm. We have disconnected from our spiritual roots. And that is why you see high form of technology, spiritual technology from this past ancient civilization. And as time went on, as we fell deeper into the material, we began to forget these secrets. And then we've hit the point now, which is the dawn of the age of Aquarius, which is, if you were to follow that same line of thought, then we are just about entering spring, where we are going to begin to remember certain aspects of this, of our past, of our true origins. And I believe that all of these sites were created for multiple reasons, but one of the reasons I feel was a way of, like your book title suggests, Richard, that it was to write a message in stone, something that could survive the ages, something that transcends language, something that is universal, in that every civilization, when it reaches a certain point of intellect and spiritual wisdom, would be able to read between the lines and get that message that there was indeed an advanced civilization before us. And I'm just, again, it's like you've got here on this, it's like it is a perennial philosophy. It's a philosophy that covered the globe. And maybe Atlantis wasn't, I mean, again, that's what we refer to it as, because that's what it was first mentioned as. But I mean, Atlantis might not have been an island. It might have been the civilization as a whole. It might have just been, that might have been the name for humanity at that point in time. And yeah, it's just going through some of these pictures. Oh, okay, this is actually a good thing that we'd get into, because this is to do with your outlook on these doorways, which you call a triptych message.
Right, the triptych temples. This is so you know, here I am, early 20s. I had graduated from college, and I had already been kind of disillusioned with the whole Egyptology explanation of history and Egyptian history, and I had already butted heads with some professors about the idea that ancient cultures were probably related because of the parallels. And I was told that, you know, I had no future in Egyptology if I had that type of outlook. So I was starting to become a little depressed and a little bit doubtful of what I was going to do, because I really was interested in Egyptology. I still am. And so I decided to travel. And I started traveling to different places in the world. And two of those places were Mexico and Egypt. And what I found, I was looking for parallels. I was looking for things that the Victorian era scholars may have missed. And one of the things that that I found a lot of things, actually. I found a lot of parallels. And I have only published some of them. I haven't published all of them. But out of what I've published, one of the most important things I found was that cultures around the world, and especially the pyramid cultures, all built the same three-door temples. And I started to call them triptych temples, named after the Renaissance artwork. You know, they have the triptych, they call it the triptych with three panels, with the two panels on either side being the same width and height, but the panel in the middle being larger and slightly wider, taller and slightly wider than the twins flanking it. And so I started to find this everywhere I went, and I was amazed by it. And again, it was very prominent among the pyramid cultures. And I started to look into it more deeply, and I became very excited because, hey, these are the temples. You know, this isn't just some very small, insignificant idol that they all had, and a 2-inch by 3-inch idol, or some type of sign that or symbol that they all used, like the spiral, for example. They all used the spiral. But that's not really profound. I mean, you can't really build an argument on the idea that cultures around the world use the spiral. But hey, these are temples, and temples are where you go to worship, or not necessarily to worship, but, you know, spiritual places where you go to connect with the higher self or whatever higher power you might believe in. So I really, this was a turning point for me. I'd found this everywhere, and I'm still finding them among different cultures. But, you know, no matter where I looked, India, China, in Europe, in Africa, in the Americas, everywhere, ancient cultures, all the pyramid cultures built these triptych temples. And at first I had just noticed the aesthetic parallel. I didn't know what they stood for, but I would soon embark on a quest to try to decipher what these meant. And this is a perfect example right here. These are all Mayan triptych temples. And the reason I put this collage together is to show that it wasn't just one temple that the Maya built. There are dozens and dozens and dozens of triptych temples that you can find across Mesoamerica and Guatemala, Nicaragua, Mexico, et cetera, built by the Maya civilization. And this is just one example. Of course, if you go to Egypt, there are many triptych temples in Egypt. If you go to China, there are many triptych temples in China. And so you'll see that as we go, I have more examples of that. So if you want to go to the next slide, I'm not sure what it is. We threw these together in no random order.
What ones am I looking for, dude? Is it going
to
be...
Any ones, if you just want to go to the next one and just keep going, it's... Okay, so this is a good example. The one before that?
This one?
Yeah. So one of the... As I started to research the idea of triptych temples, I started to notice more parallels. And one of these parallels... I was always interested in Hinduism, and one of the key concepts of Hinduism is the Ajna chakra, the third eye chakra. And I was reading occult books at the time, and they all talked about awakening your third eye. You know, that was the big thing that I found in most of the occult books I was reading at the time. I'm still in my mid-20s here, mid-1990s. And so I started to realize that, hey, is it possible that it wasn't just a concept found among the Hindus, that maybe other ancient cultures also had this idea of awakening the third eye? And I would later find that not only is it related to the triptych, but, you know, the three doors of the triptych and the third eye, but it's also something that's found in different cultures, and most archaeologists have not recognized it. And on the left, it's an example of the examples from the Olmec, Toltec, and I think that's Maya or Aztec cultures here. You could see the dot on the forehead. That dot on the forehead, in India, it's called the Bindi dot, and it's the symbol of the Ajna chakra, the awakened third eye. And what the third eye is just it's an organ of inward sight, that whereas your two eyes see outward at material things, the third eye, when it's awakened, looks inward at spiritual things, namely your soul, the eternal being within you. So these images from the Americas on the left, and I also found it in Egypt on the right, and these are some examples. These are examples of the idea that when you awaken your third eye, you transcend the material bodily aspect of yourself, and you recognize that you are an eternal being. You see the soul within, and you transcend materiality. You recognize the spiritual, and you see it not only within yourself, but in the world around you.
Yeah, so I've heard you discuss it before as well about the triptych doorways, in that what it represents is the duality or polarities of the universal forces of creation, and that middle path, the golden path in the middle, is the balancing of the two, and that is where you find the doorway to heaven, or the doorway to a higher source of potential.
Exactly. Yeah. The three doors of the triptych are symbolic of the third eye. Mm-hmm. And here are two examples on the left, Maya, and on the right, the Egyptian. The right one is the Temple of Seti II in Luxor. The left is the Temple of the Turtles in Uxmal, Mexico. Very, very parallel, extremely parallel looking. And maybe you can go to the next slide. This is another example. It's a different form of triptych temple, yeah. but the idea is the same. You have the space in the middle being wider than the two spaces flanking it. On the left, this is the Temple of the Jaguars in Chichen Itza in Mexico, built by the Maya. The pillars there are actually twin serpents descending. And their jaws are resting on the bottom. It's kind of hard to see in this photo. Their tails are up there, are up top, and they're kind of descending. The pillars themselves are the columns. On the right-hand side, those are in the Egyptian side. This is from the temple at the Metropolitan Museum in New York City, which I had been going to my whole life. I grew up in New York, so this was a beautiful temple, and something that I was always, I guess, looking back, you know, the triptych was always right there in front of me, and that's one of the reasons why I was able to locate it in different parts of the world. But those twin pillars there are lotus flowers, actually, opening lotus flowers. But you have the same exact concept here, the three spaces on both sides of the Atlantic Ocean. And as we go, maybe you can go to the next slide.
One thing, Richard, I'm just looking at, it's very faint, and I have to really get my face close to the computer screen. In the, so this Egyptian one that we've got, what you said this is in a New York museum. What is this taken from?
Yeah, this is a temple that was actually from Egypt that they dismantled and brought to New York City. I'm not sure when, maybe about 75 years ago or something like this.
Because you can see very faintly that in the center bit, you've got the winged sun disc.
Yep, that's exactly what it is.
Yeah, is that what it is? I thought it was. And then that would obviously make sense for it to be in a good, it's like a good metaphor of the actual, like, meaning of the central entrance point, which is the entrance into, like, solar consciousness.
Exactly. Now, watch this. This is something great. Don't change the slide. Watch this. This is really fantastic. That's the Aten symbol. And in the next few slides, I talk more about the Aten. But if you look closely, there are twin serpents emerging from that circular Aten symbol. The Aten is it's a symbol of the soul, actually. The circle with no beginning and no end has always been a symbol of eternity. The wings have always been a symbol of the higher self. Anything with wings can fly high, so it's a symbol of heights, and angelic beings have wings, heavenly beings have wings. So the circle being a symbol of eternity with the wings themselves, that's a symbol of the soul, the eternal soul, the being within us that is divine and never dies, and that animates us, the unmoved mover. So the twin serpents are emerging from the Aten. And if you think about it, I just showed that these are twin triptych temples. There are twin serpents on both of these. On the left, I had told you that those twin serpents were descending, right? Those are the two columns. Mm-hmm. And now on the right, we have twin serpents as well, here depicted on the Aten symbol. So that's really, to me, and this is something that, you know, I've known for many, many years, but this was one of the things that kind of told me that I was heading in the right direction. Not only are these parallel triptych temples, but we have parallel twin serpents as well. And I get into what the twin serpents symbolize in my work. They symbolize duality, yin and yang, left and right, Jacob and Boaz, et cetera, et cetera. And I think we'll see that more as the slides go on.
Oh, well, the next slide was Aten Hoda's time. Okay,
yeah, funny. Aten. So what does the Aten symbolize? In one of its respects, it symbolizes the third eye. And here I've shown how the Egyptian mummies, not just the pharaohs too, just the regular mummies, had the Aten symbol on their forehead. And here you can see a quote from one of the books, one of my books. It says, "The Aten stands for the awakened third eye that sees the soul within or sun within, which soul or sun is really the higher self or divine spark within us. The Aten is thus a symbol of both the third eye and the soul within that the awakened third eye sees." Wow. So the Aten, in one of its respects, is symbolic of both the awakened third eye, because as you can see here, it's put in the mummies in the position of the third eye, but it's also symbolic of the soul within. The sun is a symbol of the soul. The word soul in Latin languages, the soul means sun.
Really?
You have that, yeah, soul.
Wow.
S-O-L. So you have this kind of the idea that, just think of the concept of the sun. It's the supreme life giver of all. It's circular. Circular symbols are always symbolic of eternity. A circle has no beginning and no end, just like our souls. And by soul, I mean Atman. You know, I'm talking about in the Hindu tradition, what the Hindus would call the Atman-Brahman kind of pairing, I guess you would say. So, you know, this Aten symbol is always crowning the center door of all the Egyptian triptych temples. And the reason is because those temples were temples of the third eye. They were temples of awakening to the higher self within.
I got a quick question before we move on, Rich. I'd like your perspective. What do you think the sun is?
Ah, it's a great question. It's a great question. There's a part of me, and this is probably too deep to discuss here, but I'll just mention it anyway. I think because we're in physicality, we see the sun as the sun, you know, great big giant ball of fire. But if we could be able to truly rip off our clothing, material clothing, and see the sun, it's just the spiritual realm. It's a part of the spiritual realm that, think of, Plato said that when souls die, they go to the sun. So I would say think of like a heavenly realm. It's like a heavenly realm that is made of pure spirituality, that in some way is disguising itself in the material world as a great big ball of fire. I mean, I'm working on that, but that's something, it's a tough call because there's nothing in history written about it. And this is something that I've always kind of suspected, that it's a great spiritual being that we're only seeing the material side of.
Yeah, I'm on very similar lines to you. I think that the sun itself is, like you said, at its core, it's a spiritual entity, it's a spiritual consciousness. And if what we see in this world, in our reality, is from the light of the sun, light, photons, it's information, just as we go through our cycles of sleep and wake, I think the sun also goes through stages. And that's why we see, like, the solar system is heating up. Like, that is one of the causes for all of the events on this planet that we're experiencing, is that the solar system is heating up. The sun is heating up. It is, something is happening to it, which we can record on a physical level. But like you said, if we were able to strip off our materialistic clothing, then maybe we would see something much more profound happening on the sun as it's going through its evolutionary cycle. And the consciousness of the sun is almost awakening, which is then causing us to awaken through the photons that we are registering into our systems. And
yeah,
I'm just seeing some.
So here we're getting these are two temples that I had shown on the screen earlier. Now I'm getting to the point where I started to realize that these aren't just aesthetically parallel temples, but they actually are pointing to a deeper wisdom, a deeper body of wisdom, what I call the universal religion, and what I now call the perennial philosophy, just because more people can relate to that. And it really is a part of the perennial philosophy. But at the time, I called it the universal religion. And really what that is the idea of the balance of the opposites. And that's a core piece of the occult tradition. It's a core piece of alchemy. It's a core piece of Hermeticism. The idea of the balance of the opposites, the reconciliation of our opposites, the marriage of opposites, the harmony of opposites. It's called in Latin the coincidentia oppositorum, the idea that everything in the material world is made of opposites, hot, cold, right, left, woman, man, sun, moon, yin, yang, etc. So those are represented by the twin outer doors of the triptych. So those twin outer doors are always symbolic of the duality, while the center door is symbolic of the source. Because, and the source is spiritual. The duality is physical, but the source is spiritual. And the idea that there are three in one is because in true reality, once you can really cover this teaching, you'll see that it's all really spiritual. Everything around us is spiritual. The idea that we're living in a fallen realm of materiality. It's good to kind of look into, for a newcomer to this wisdom, to look at the material world as having fallen from the spiritual world. It's good because your mind needs to grasp it. But then when you graduate from that idea, you realize it's all spiritual. It's all, everything in the material world had its source in the spiritual world and is therefore spiritual. And if you just leave this on for 1 second, I can show you this idea of the harmony of opposites. I started to find it in all the cultures that I found triptych temples and pyramids. On the left in Mexico, here's a quote from Mercedes de la Garza, a archaeologist from Mexico. She says, the basic concept of the Maya religion and that of Mesoamerica in general is harmony of opposites. In the middle, in Egypt, Henri Frankfurt was a lecturer of Egyptology. He says, the deeply rooted Egyptian tendency is to understand the world as a series of pairs of contrasts balanced in unchanging equilibrium. Egyptian thought is that a totality comprises opposites. And I've been quoting this for about 20 years now. It's appeared in all my books and in my videos and lectures. On the right-hand side, a scholar of Hinduism, Stephen Rosen, said in Asia, Cambodia, you see there, the ability to see the harmony is nowhere more prominent than in Indian theology. Transcending of all pairs of opposites is central to Hindu thought. So at this point, I'm recognizing that not only did the pyramid cultures build the same triptych temples, but in these cultures, the idea of the harmony of opposites was the central belief. And I link that central belief to the three doors of the triptych. The opposites are the twin outer doors, and the harmony or the balance or the equilibrium is the middle door. And that's what their religion was. I'm convinced, I'm convinced beyond a doubt. In 10, 15 years ago, I was still putting this together. Actually, my book Written in Stone came out almost 10 years ago. And that's the reason I decided to publish it, is because I had already been convinced at that point. And so I'm more than convinced now that these pyramid cultures, their triptych temples, all stand for the balance of opposites, the totality of opposites. And here's an example of cross-cultural parallel signs and ideas. On the top is the Aten symbol, which we just talked about. And I'm showing how it's those twin serpents are really the yin and yang. And the reason is because the Egyptians depicted the twin serpents wearing the white crown and the red crown. If you could see that, I kind of superimposed that just to make it clear. The white crown was symbolic of Upper Egypt. Egypt was divided into two lands, they called them, the two lands of Upper and Lower Egypt. And the king of Upper Egypt wore the white crown, and the king of Lower Egypt wore the red crown. And these two kingdoms were battling, according to Egyptologists, for hundreds of years, perhaps thousands of years, until King Narmer united the twin kingdoms around 3100 BC, thereby forming everything that we know as dynastic Egypt. Dynastic Egypt is the pharaohs and so on and so forth. So the idea here is that the twin serpents symbolize duality, just like the yin and yang, and that the uniting of the twin serpents, the uniting of the white crown and red crown, is the key. That's the center door of the triptych. That's the exercise that we all need to perform in order to transcend the duality of our own physical bodies and reach the soul within. And there's a quote here. The twin serpents were often depicted wearing the white and red crowns of Upper and Lower Egypt, showing us that Egypt's Aten perfectly parallels China's Taijitu or yin-yang symbol. The serpent of Upper Egypt wearing the white crown parallels yang. The serpent of Lower Egypt wearing the red crown parallels yin. And just as yin and yang are encompassed by the Tao circle of eternity, so the Aten circle organizes Egypt's twin serpents into a higher unity, balancing them in unchanging equilibrium. So these are symbols of the soul in Egypt and in China. And they're exactly the same symbol, you know. And China was a pyramid building culture with triptych temples. Egypt was a pyramid building culture with triptych temples. And so what I've done here is show how their symbols here are the same.
Fascinating.
Sorry, and I'm talking too much.
No, not at all, Richard. Like I'm loving it. I'm just sitting here, just like it allows me to, because all of these ideas of things that I've obviously studied from your own work and others in the past, and then obviously having you to be able to describe it to me is amazing. So I'm just sat here just enjoying it, man. You talk as much as you want. I'm having a good time. And we just moved on now for everyone that's listening to the God Self icon, which I'm guessing is a subject that we could move on to, which is very similar to the premise which we just laid down just then.
Yeah, it is. It's again, the triptych was just one of the symbols of the temples that I had discovered. In many of those temples and in other iconography, I've found this parallel motif all around the world. And what it is basically is the god of the culture has both arms outstretched and is grasping twin objects in each hand. Most of the time, they're animals. Sometimes they're staffs. And oftentimes they're serpents, actually. As I did research more and more into this, I realized that in the old world, scholars had already recognized this posture, this icon, and they called it the master of animals. And if it was a woman, it was called the mistress of animals. Mm-hmm. And so I felt like I was onto something there. But in the new world, among the Peruvian cultures, among the Inca and Pre-Inca cultures, they had the very same symbol. They had the exact same symbol. You could see it there. In the upper left-hand corner. They call it the staff god. And so what I did in my second book, Missing Link, is to show that I fleshed out a chapter in Written in Stone, actually. Basically, I wanted to show that this, what I call the God Self icon, is a parallel symbol used by the pyramid cultures, used by the triptych building cultures, to essentially explain the same wisdom, which is the idea of transcending duality and finding the center within. If you look closely, they're sort of a triptych. Each one of them is sort of a triptych, with the body of the god or the hero forming the center door, and the twin outer doors being the twin animals. And again, in each of these cultures, there's much more than I'm explaining here, but the body itself, ancient cultures all around the world perceive the two sides of the body. If you cut a line right straight down the body with your left eye and your right eye, your left shoulder and your right shoulder, your left arm and your right arm, left leg, right leg, they believe that the two sides of your body were formed of opposites, the solar side, the yang side, and the lunar side, the yin side. And so the idea was to balance the two and bring them together. It's kind of a metaphor for the inner alchemy that we all need to do in order, again, to transcend the duality of the material world. So what this is a reinforcement of the triptych discovery by showing how the gods of all the triptych building cultures use the same iconography, essentially to symbolize the same idea of transcending duality. And here's more examples.
Literally all over the world. It covers the, like, you got, so just back on here, Peru, Afghanistan, Egypt, Colombia, Italy, Lebanon, China, India, Nigeria, Spain, Iraq, Greece, Bolivia, Egypt, North America, Sumer, Giraffe, where's that?
Yeah, Giraffe, actually, it's interesting because Giraffe is said to have been a Persian culture, a very ancient Persian culture. They say it goes back to 3500 BC. But the artifacts that were discovered, they were not excavated, but they were found. It appears that some grave robbers or some tomb raiders stole the artifacts, never explained where they got them from, and then somehow they fell into the hands of a museum. So nobody's actually exactly sure where the Giraffe ruins and artifacts come from, but they are guessing that it's in Persia somewhere in modern Iran.
See, for me, this is just like, it's such a joke. It's such a joke that mainstream history, archaeology doesn't take this shit seriously. Like, look at it. You can come from this from, you can take someone who's got absolutely no foundational knowledge on this and tell them, and they're gonna be like, well, obviously it's all related. Like, you can look at it and it's like these countries are supposedly had no communication with each other, yet all of their imagery, all of their sacred symbology is mirror images of each other. And that's from someone that's in the Amazon of South America to all of us, to being in Africa, to being in Asia. So, and they've all got it's literally the exact same. When you're looking at it like this, it's as clear as day.
Yeah, absolutely.
Wow.
Yeah.
Fascinating. And then
Past this one. This is a one that we had looked at. Okay, so here I started to realize that the lost ancient universal religion of the Triptych Temple was the founding wisdom of all secret societies. So now we're going on to a different line of research. After discovering the Triptych Temples, after recognizing that they all stood for the same transcendence of opposites teaching, I started to recognize the triptych in modern secret society architecture. And we're in the, I guess, mid-90s, 97, 98 maybe. And, the dial-up AOL, you've got mail, you know, there wasn't much information on the internet. I had never even heard of the Freemasons. I had never heard of the Freemasons. So when I started to see the triptych in these buildings, I started to wonder, and eventually it led me to realize that there exists something called secret societies, the Freemasons, the Skull and Bones, the Shriners, Knights of Pythias, Odd Fellows, there are many of them. And their architecture, and mainly their headquarters, their lodges, their halls, their temples, all have these triptych entrances. And that blew me away because I started to wonder, you know, what is this about? And if you look at their iconography, they have symbols from ancient cultures. Mm-hmm. And not just one ancient culture. There's not just an Egyptian lodge, Masonic lodge. There are Egyptian Masonic lodges. There are Babylonian Masonic lodges. There are Assyrian Masonic lodges. And that kind of proved to me that what I would later realize would be that these modern secret societies are really the inheritors of this ancient universal religion.
Mm-hmm.
And if they're building, I mean, Freemasonry, it's a building society, and it makes sense because these ancient temples and pyramids were made by master masons. They were made by master builders. And so it would make sense that the wisdom that they encoded in these ancient temples and pyramids and triptychs would have filtered down through history and would be retained in the architecture and in the symbology and iconography of these modern secret societies, who I was realizing at the time were building. Yeah, you can go to the next one. That's a good one, actually. We're building, you know, Freemasons are said to have built the Gothic cathedrals of Europe. And then I started to look into the Gothic cathedrals, and lo and behold, they're triptych entrances. And that was another eye opener for me. And I spent another many years of research looking into that. And I came to the conclusion that all of the Gothic cathedrals of Europe were built by the Freemasons, and they encode the exact same transcendence of opposites or balance of opposites teaching that we find in the ancient temples of the pyramid cultures, triptych temples of the pyramid cultures. And the architecture surrounding the triptych is explaining what the triptych is. You have, maybe you can go to the next slide. I think the next slide, actually there's more, the triptych right there. That's an example. Well, you can keep going.
So, Denver Masonic. Yeah,
there's an example of a triptych. And it has no architectural or structural purpose. It's purely symbolic. You can see the third eye directly above the doorway. It's
Kind of
in all directions.
Crazy.
Yeah. There's another slide. I think it might be next. Well, there's some triptychs in these are the Odd Fellows. Okay. The Three Link Society. You see triptychs on their architecture. And I was blown away. Didn't read this in any books. I've looked into thousands of books for this. I didn't want to publish my book written in stone until I was absolutely sure that no one had covered this before. Because if somebody had covered this before, I would have loved it. I would have loved to have been able to read what they wrote about it and look at everything that I was seeing for myself, but was discovering that I realized now was just new stuff for me, but that has never really been published. I've never seen anyone publish anything on this. Of course, I haven't read every book in history, but at this point, I'm virtually sure. So here's what I was saying. the Gothic cathedrals, which all have the same blueprint. I shouldn't say all have. Most of them have this blueprint. And what the blueprint is there are twin towers on top. There's a rose window in the center, and there's a triptych three-door entrance on the bottom. The triptych entrance is a memorial to the ancient triptych, universal religion of the triptych temple. The rose window being a circle, symbol of the soul, directly above and aligned with the middle door of the triptych. Take the middle door, be balanced between duality, transcend duality by going within, by taking the middle door. And the twin towers, notice how the twin towers align. If you follow each tower down, they align with the doors of duality, right? You have the tower on the left side goes down to the left-hand door, and the tower on the right side goes down to the right-hand door, and that's because they symbolize the doors of opposites. And I show information about that in my research, if you want to go to the next.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so there it is, the Masonic Jochen and Boaz.
Yeah, then I actually joined the Masons in 2000. I think it was 2000 or 2001. Actually, I think it was 2000. Because I figured, hey, they have all the information I'm looking for. This is beautiful. You know, here we go. I'm going to be initiated and I'm, you know, long lost brother, prodigal son coming home. But you know what? I was very disappointed when I joined, because not only did I find that they had complete amnesia of any kind of any of this history that I was realizing, but I also found that a majority of the members were absolutely not interested in any of this. Mm-hmm. And this was almost 20 years, about 20 years ago now. It's changing now with some of the social media.
I don't know, Richard. I'm going to tell you from experience that my experience within my initiation and my Masonic career mirrors yours very similar, in that I feel like the majority, say 90% of operating Masons are just completely oblivious to this. They have no interest whatsoever. And that's why it's so fascinating when someone within the craft comes out and talks about this, because it validates everything that Freemasonry is about. And it's a shame that so many of operative Masons are just clueless to this, because otherwise, like, you're looking at this picture here on the left, and most Masons are going to look at that, and they're going to know is the names for each individual aspect, but they're not going to understand the symbolism. They're not going to understand the spiritual significance of the overarching message of the art form itself. And this information needs to be passed down, otherwise it will just become lost in time.
I can't agree with you more, Chris. I really can't. And, you know, we've had the same exact experience, obviously. And when I, you know, it was especially, I mean, for me, I was coming to Freemasonry and I was thinking that I really hit the jackpot and this was it for me. And I, you know, these guys were going to just, you know, illuminate everything that I've been searching for up until then, but it was the complete opposite. And that's actually why I began publishing my book, because I started giving lectures about this. For example, I was showing everybody my research up to this point, and this is one of the photos that I used. Now we're in 2003, maybe 2004, and I started to show them, hey, you know, the tracing board is actually a blueprint of these Gothic cathedrals. You have the Jachin and Boaz pillars. The Jachin is the sun pillar. If you look at atop the pillar, there's a symbol of the sun, and the Boaz pillar is the one on the right with the moon, the symbol of the moon on it. And as we said before, that's the solar, lunar. The sun brings warmth and heat of the day, and the moon brings the cold and darkness of night. And so they're symbolic of really all the pairs of opposites, the yin and the yang, the left and the right, et cetera, et cetera. Mm-hmm. And the all-seeing eye, which every Mason that I talked to said, that's the eye of God. That's the Bible. I said, no, it's not. That's the third eye. That's the Ajna chakra. That's the awakened third eye. That we use to transcend duality, and it's written into the Gothic cathedrals. And I started giving lectures, and you know, a lot of brothers were turned off, but a lot of them were turned on. And within a very, very short time, 2-3 years, my lectures started to gain popularity, and I started giving a lecture every month, and that eventually turned into me writing the book.
Yeah, the exact same experience. Like I was initiated when I was 18, and I went in there all starry-eyed, thinking that, yeah, I'd hit gold. I thought I was going to be in amongst these awakened individuals.
And then I was sorely disappointed to find myself discussing, whatever 80-year-old guys discuss over dinner and wine. And I was just like, fucking hell. I was just like, there must be more to it than this. I was like, I just went through this whole initiation process and they kept telling me the same things that, oh, you're going to understand it as when you're older, you're going to understand it as you progress. And it's like, you don't even know. You don't even know yourself.
Exactly. I know. I can relate. So yeah, this is what we just, I was just pointing to the sun and the Jachin column and the moon and the Boaz column. And, you know, there's more we could talk about, the duality of the checkerboard floor. Again, this concept of polarity, duality, the black squares being the yin, the white squares being the yang. The idea that it's a floor means that we are, you know, it's the ground of our being. The duality forms the ground of our being. Our world cannot exist with just the yang side, nor can it exist with just the yin side. We need to walk on top the duality and not be thrown around left and right by it. We're going to have good days. We're going to have bad days, but stay in the center, know who you are, stay balanced. You know, the coffin in the, and on the shot below, all the way on the, in the front below means you need to die to your lower self. You know, something bad happens. We all want to curse and scream and, you know, kill the other guy or whatever it is. Don't do it. Because that's not who you are. You have to transcend that ego self. When you transcend the ego, when you die to your lower self, you can be reborn to the higher self. That's what that coffin symbolizes. And notice how it's aligned with the eye atop. The alignments are very important in these symbols. Because they really they teach you a lot right there in the alignments. The other symbols we could get into another time, maybe. These are less important, but here's a good example. The sun, the sun, if you look on the left and right, day is opposed to night. We see the sun during the day on the left, we see the moon during the night on the right. And the sun brings light and the night brings dark. The sun brings hot, the moon brings cold. During the day it's dry and during the night it's moist. The sun symbolizes life and the moon symbolizes death. And here in the world of duality, we perceive sun as being good and we perceive the moon as being night and dark and evil. Mm. And that's just an idea of symbolism of how the sun and moon kind of engender and denote or symbolize all the pairs of opposites, all the duality in existence.
Yes, man. That's a great way of putting it.
Yeah.
And then
there's just to show you the twin towers or the towers of duality, you know, the sun tower and the moon tower. And if you follow them down, they lead to the doors of opposites. Those are the twin outer doors of the triptych.
And then we got more of the God self.
Right. And these are the God self icons that are found in churches and cathedrals and some of them in castles. And of course, we know who built those. Those were the operative Freemasons, right? The operative Freemasons were the builders of these cathedrals, churches. In the Middle East, the mosques. This is something I used to talk a lot more about, not so much anymore, but, you know, a lot of these corporate giants in modern times understand a lot more than many of us realize of what these symbols mean. These are ancient symbols. They were known all over the world. And there's a concept that Carl Jung talked about, race memory, sometimes called genetic memory or the collective unconscious, where we may not necessarily have personal memory of these symbols, but deep down in our unconscious, there's a memory of the human race that we all share. And, you know, he's talked about the archetypes, and this is an archetypical symbol. And the reason why Starbucks took it was because they knew that we'd be attracted to it. So we see the symbol and we're attracted to it. Whatever, it could have been coffee, it could have been tea, it could have been cake, whatever it was, I think it would have been a $1 billion company no matter what, because these are powerful symbols and we're all attracted to them.
Yeah, I mean, every multinational corporation, if you look at their logos, it's either got some form of very mild sacred geometry or some archetypical symbol that roots deep into prehistory, and it has an effect on our consciousness when we observe it. And it's a subconscious effect as well, and that's why people are drawn into these places,
not knowing exactly what draws us, but we're drawn. And here we see the Starbucks logo, and you know, from hundreds of years ago.
Crazy. And then I love these little quotes.
Man is the God in Ruins, Ralph Waldo Emerson. As I said, the soul is a God, you know. The soul is a piece of the God. The soul is a God, limited in his nature, infinite in his desire. Man is a fallen God who remembers heaven. Fallen because we're now in the world of duality and we have amnesia of who we really are. Mm-hmm. We have amnesia of our own inner godhood. We think we're just animals living on a planet. We're not. We're deities. And we, as I explained, we created all of this. It's all our own creation. And that's something that I talk about also. There is no matrix. We created the matrix. We are the God. We created the duality. That's why the twin serpents issue from the Aten, because the Aten, the circular Aten symbol, is the soul. It is the God. That's who we really are, the spiritual self. The twin serpents come from that. The circle is the source of the serpents. In the yin yang, the yin and the yang are enclosed, encapsulated into the circle of the Tao.
Yeah,
man. Here's a great one. Man is a god in the body of an animal, according to the pronouncement of ancient philosophy. Alvin Boyd Kuhn, he was absolutely right, because that's what the ancients teach. And this is a concept you find everywhere in the world, and probably more, if I was speaking to a scholar, I would just point to Hinduism, the Atman, the Brahman, it's right there. Giordano Bruno, his Grand Master certificate. This one I tried to use to convince Masons that the Jakin pillar has the sun pillar, the male pillar. And the Boaz pillar on the right is the lunar pillar. You see the moon above and the sun above. That's the female pillar. And they're actually, the triangle is important too. Those twin opposites form the twin lower points of a triangle, whereas the apex of the triangle is the center. It's the balance point. And the triangle, like a triptych, have the same TRI prefix. So the triptych and the triangle are really parallel symbols. With the center door of the triptych being parallel to the apex of the triangle and the twin doors of duality matching up to the two lower points of the triangle.
Fascinating. And then some more sort of...
This is a God self icon. A lot of the manuscripts, illuminated manuscripts in the last several hundred years, esoteric manuscripts, have this kind of God self icon. And the reason I call it the God self icon, I didn't say earlier, is because it's how you find your God within, by balancing the duality. And here you have a male holding the sun on the right, and a female holding the moon on the left. It's really a symbol. It's a symbol of our metaphysical selves, half male, half female, united. And there's a little drawing I did of the sun, right side masculine, moon, left side feminine. Mm-hmm. And it's only this is the duality that the ancients talked about. If you look at Egypt or Mexico or China or India, they all have this idea that the right side of the body is solar and male, and the left side is lunar and female.
And that's interesting, because it's the right hemisphere of the brain is what controls the left side of the body, and people that are left-handed are, generally speaking, they embody more of the feminine energy, the divine feminine. Mm-hmm. And vice versa as well, for the right side of the body being controlled by the left side of the brain, which makes you much more analytical, much more logical compared to the creative force of the right hemisphere. I like that. That's a cool diagram, man. And then what are we on now? Just a little bit more of an explanation.
We can keep going through this. That's the third eye. Great quote from Plato. I actually minored in philosophy in college. I loved philosophy. I knew I didn't want to major in it. I knew I wasn't going to get a job in philosophy, but I really enjoyed it and I wanted to continue. So I read all of Plato, I read all of Socrates. In every man, there's an eye of the soul, which is far more precious than 10,000 bodily eyes, for by it alone is truth seen. Great quote from Plato. Just a symbol of I tried to show the brothers that, look, there's the all-seeing eye is not the eye of Yahweh of the Bible. It's the third eye of the ancient East. You know, this is one of the symbols.
Did they like that or not?
No.
Thought not.
The third eye dot, you know, it's symbolic of the third eye, the Bindi dot of India, the Ajna Chakra. They didn't like that one either. That didn't impress them.
I don't think much is going to impress them, to be honest with you.
You know, there, if your mind is closed, it's not going to open. But there's a lot of, you know, especially now these days, there's more brothers who are open-minded to this, but still a major problem with esotericism and Freemasonry. Here's a great God self icon. with actually the third eye. And you could see the two eyes, you could see the God Self icon holding the twin Ankhs parallel in each hand. I kind of just broke it down here. This is an Egyptian. There's a couple of these if you go forward.
Yeah. So is this meant to be Isis or is this anyone in particular?
Yeah, I think it's Isis on all three of these. There's one more.
Interesting.
That, yeah, I think that's the same one we did. And there's another one. He's called Hay. This was something that kind of again showed me that I was on the path.
Is that what he's called, Hay?
Yeah, yeah.
Does that have something to do with why we go Hay?
I don't know.
I don't know, man. A lot of our language is rooted in esoteric ideas.
Yeah, totally. Yeah, I get that. I totally agree. And I'd love to spend a year studying that. You know? This is, hey, he's the God of eternity. And again, this is the God Self icon. When you balance the twin opposites, you know, which is what this pose is suggesting, you find the eternity within you. This is a concept based on scholarly Egyptology research.
Interesting. Then we have like the petroglyphs.
Yeah, Long Man of Wilmington. This is in England. This is the holding twin staffs in each hand. I think this is the biggest depiction of a human being in all of Europe, actually. This is on the side of a mountain. I forget which one it is right now. I think it's, I don't want to guess, but this again was showing me that I was on the path and that this God Self icon was a symbol found all around the world.
Fascinating.
Yeah.
And
this is the rebus in Freemasonry. We have the rebus symbol, which again is a God Self icon. You could see the rebus, the male head on the right is holding the solar compass and the female head on the left is holding the lunar square. And as you know, the Masonic square and compass is the key symbol of Freemasonry. And it's usually put one atop the other in a blending or in a combining of the two. And that's the idea of the balance of the opposites, the transcending of the opposites. You could see above the rebus's head is the six-pointed star, the upside-down triangle combined with the right-side-up triangle. And again, that's the symbol of the balance, the harmony of opposites.
And what does the green dragon represent?
I could go the easy way and I probably will just for now because we're kind of running out of time, but you could say that that's the ego self that you need to conquer in order to realize the higher true self. You know, we all have the ego, the anger, the jealousy, the viciousness that really comes with a part of being an animal in this world. But we're not animals, we're gods. So we need to transcend that animal self. And when we do, things begin to fall into place. And standing atop the dragon is a conquering of the dragon. There's a lot more to it, but we probably better not get too deeply into it right now. And there's that symbol again, the six-pointed star. This is an Etruscan bracelet. It might be Greek, actually. I found recently that one scholar says it's Greek. But anyway, just wanted to show how the Aten, the circumpunct symbol, which is also a Masonic symbol, and the hexagram, the six-pointed star, it goes back to ancient times. And this is a symbol that I used, a meme that I used, I think, on Twitter several years ago.
Ooh, and okay, so this is to do with the serpent.
Parallels between the Maya culture and Bali. On top, the twin serpent banisters. Those could be dragons on the left. It could be serpents. And the top one, it's basically showing the same architecture that these twin cultures shared. Again, going back, this is what initially got me interested in all of this, these parallels between cultures, these visual architectural parallels between cultures. What does it all mean? And that's really how I got to where I am. It started with this. On the left, the Egyptian third eye, you know, the Aten symbol with the twin serpents. And on the right, the Hindu Ajna chakra, the third eye. And I wanted to show in this they're basically the same. It's the same symbol. And
yes, I love the bit, your body is a temple for the living deity. That's I know you would have read it anyway, but Shwana de Lubick's work of the temple of man. That's fascinating. And that's one of the things I always talk about is how the body itself is a biological temple. And how these temples were modeled after the human body to become a, like you said, like a cosmic man in order to, as above, so below, bring the heavens down onto earth. Oh man.
Absolutely.
Getting into the juicy shit now, Rich, and we ain't got much time left.
Yeah, we could probably skip over this because I talked about this, the parallel third eye.
Oh, could we talk about the swastika for like the last like 5 minutes or so?
We could stay. I have another, how long do you have?
Well, I have as long as you want to go, man. I know you said that you needed to go at 6, which would be like half an hour from now. So
I could do, let's do another 20 minutes.
20 minutes? Sound. Yeah. Yes.
Okay. Sick. I'll rush. We'll have to rush off then and run, but that's good. So the Atlantis swastika. Why do I call it that? Another Plato quote that I'd come across that I loved. You remember only one deluge, though there have been many. You and your fellow citizens are descended from the few survivors that remain, but you know nothing about it because so many succeeding generations left no record in writing. Only a small part of the human race survives. Do you know where that's from? You had mentioned it before, Solon and the Greeks.
Is it from that?
Yeah. So
interesting.
Yeah. And
I haven't heard that quote before. That's
it's a good
yeah.
one.
Yeah, that yeah. is a good one.
Yeah. So the idea is, you know, this is what scholars these days, archaeologists, are not paying attention to. And they should pay attention to it because Plato is a very reliable source. And it's a 1,000-year-old source, several 2,500-year-old source, let's say. And I think it needs to be reevaluated. And one of the reasons why I liked it, and I matched it up with the swastika, because the swastika is a symbol that we find in essentially every ancient culture around the world. And it appears multiple times in each culture. And so the swastika, in its simplest explanation, is it's a yin-yang. And it's a quick explanation, but it's a symbol of the two S's. Look at it as two S symbols that are matched and find a common center. And you could spin it around like the seasons, you know, the four seasons. You have the four sides of the swastika. You have north, south, east, west. You have winter, spring, summer, fall, right? You have the concept of earth, air, water, fire. And all of that is showing the material aspect of things. And the center of the swastika, when if you twirl it, you'll notice that that center stays still. And that's the source. The source is the eternal center, the eternal part of this symbol. And the twirling part, the four ends, are what we experience in duality, in the world of duality. You could say summer and winter, but you could also say, hey, well, there's spring and fall in there too. And that's, you know, that's sort of, you have two S symbols, but it's actually four. You see what I mean?
Mm-hmm. Yep.
And I love the quote from, and I'm not a fan of Hitler, but when you think about it, he was a historical person. I do think he had access to documents or information that we no longer have access to. And so I quote him in some of my work, and this is a good example. He says, I've never regarded the Chinese or the Japanese as being inferior to ourselves. They belong to ancient civilizations, and I admit freely that their past history is superior to our own. And that's kind of a surprising quote coming from Hitler. But why I use it is because I wanted to show how he seems to be saying that he believes that ancient cultures were superior. And that's what I believe. And I believe that he had access to information that we no longer have access to. And that's one of the reasons why I think he took the swastika, was because he had this type of information. And he knew something that a lot of modern archaeologists and modern people in general just don't know.
For sure. And obviously the Nazis were evil as fuck, but putting that aside, they were way ahead of the Allies. They studied esoterica. They had the real society, which was operated through Maria Osagich, which is one of the world's greatest channelers, and they created this advanced technology that pretty much would have won them the war if it was seen through to the end. They developed the SS Bell and all of these other high technological feats, which are believed to have now been stored down in Antarctica, where they fled after their lost in the war, and they took all that technology down there, which is the reason why the Antarctica is such a hot spot for governments of the world, where there is a central peace treaty where everyone has a little piece of the action down there. And do you know much about Antarctica, Rich? Have you done much research down there?
I have done very little to none.
Oh, it's honestly, Rich, check out the work from Dr. Michael Sala. There's a lot of interesting stuff. There is pyramids being found down there. There is, they believe that there is ruins down there, which now that the ice is melting, we've got a lot of private corporations and governmental organizations that are down there doing research on it. And there's a lot of whistleblowers that have come out with some of the work that's being done. Very, very fascinating. And but yeah, story for another day. Let's crack on with...
Right. Yeah. Just as assembly of photos that I was trying to show how the Aten symbol, the circle with these wings and serpents that always appears above the center door of Egyptian triptych temples. Mm-hmm. You can see there are three temples there. They have three spaces. They all share the same three spaces with the two columns forming those three spaces. And they all have the Aten symbol in crowning the center door of these triptych temples in Egypt. And on the left, you could see that that Aten symbol is the third eye.
Yes. So it's so evident when it's laid out like this, and you can just see it after source after source after source. It's like straight there.
Yeah, this is exactly what I was trying to show with this picture as well, that in India, it was the same as in Egypt. See, the beauty of it is that scholars understand that the Bindi dot in India is the Ajna chakra. It's the third eye chakra. So I use India as kind of a basis when I'm trying to explain what this is about, because they already recognize it in India. Yes, it's known. It's the third eye. Okay. Nothing new here. What's new is, hey, it's in Egypt too.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, man. And then...
Again, parallel corbel architecture between Bali and the Maya, and they have the same hand mudras. If you look closely at their hands, they're kind of doing the same hand gesture. It's used in Hindu and Buddhist yoga. It helps the body regain a state of balance or equilibrium.
Well, what have we got here? Now we're getting into lizard territory.
Yeah, so as I continued researching, I started to see triptych temples in modern architecture. And here are three examples on the left, the Bank of England and the Bank of France and Rockefeller Center. Now, when we think of the banks and the Rockefellers, what do we think of?
Evil lizards.
We don't think of great things, do we, right? We think of people who were basically in charge of us and who have lied to us and maybe who are hiding information. And I think... the idea here is that they understood the triptych and they used it in their architecture. The triptych is not good. It's not evil. It's like the Tao. You know, when you talk about the Tao, there's yin flowing through it and there's yang flowing through it. There's good, there's evil, but that's just one way to look at it. But anyway, the triptych is the same. It's the idea that transcending the duality. So anyway, there's more to it, but too deep to get into here, but just wanted to show the Bank of England had the triptych. They, on the top, you could see that on the doorways, they used the caduceus symbol. And the caduceus is, again, a triptych in the sense that the twin serpents are the duality. And the idea is to, in India, you have the Ida and Pingala channels. Those are the two left and right channels. You can think of them as the twin sides of the body, the yin and the yang. And the idea is to awaken the Ajna chakra by balancing those twin forces in your body. By calling the serpent power up to the forehead, it awakens the third eye. Mm-hmm. So the triptych here is showed on the Bank of England, associated with the concept of the caduceus. And the caduceus is really an esoteric symbol of Kundalini yoga in India, which is the awakening of the third eye. Mm-hmm. In the middle with the Bank of France, there's a great one. That's an eye symbol, actually, directly above the middle door. Do you see that?
Yeah.
It's very stylized. It's highly stylized so that any Joe walking on the street can't say, hey, what's that eye symbol doing up there? You got to know that you're looking for it. And that's an eye. I'm completely convinced. And on the bottom, Rockefeller Center, he's actually holding a Masonic compass in his hand, the god in the middle. There's a male occupying the right side, a female occupying the left side of the triptych, and in the middle door of the triptych, there's a god symbol. And that is balance the twin sides, and you find the god within, which is who you really are.
It's so fucking evident, man. It's like right there. And people just walk past this day in and day out and would not give a fuck.
I have no idea what it means or its history or... And here's a good example of the concept of three in Europe. This is like the triptych. I've never seen this in any book where somebody has said, hey, these ancient symbols of Europe all are symbolic of the number three. You have the Druids, the Merovingians, the Fleur-de-Lis, the Celtic Triquetra, the Trinacria symbol in Sicily, which is where my relatives came from, the Germanic symbol, the Trefot, and the Norse Odin's knot. And really what I've seen here is these are pre-Christian symbols that were later co-opted by Christianity and used as symbols of the Holy Trinity, especially the Celtic Triquetra and the Fleur-de-Lis. Those more than any of the others.
Crazy.
And then just more parallels that kind of led me onto this quest. This is the protruding tongue. This is actually one. This one was discovered by past scholars. It's been known about 70 years. But I don't think any scholars realize that there's a more important parallel, which is that it's a circular symbol. And on both sides of the Atlantic Ocean, the protruding tongue is forming the very center of the circle. And we know that as the circumpunct. The circle with a dot in the center. And the dot here is shown as the deity with the protruding tongue. Mm. And I kind of go in a little further into that. This is a great quote from Victor Hugo in The Hunchback of Notre Dame. I was reading this when I was studying the cathedrals, and this, I found the pentagram and the hexagram and a lot of other esoteric symbols encoded in the cathedrals. And that was one of the tip-offs, I guess you could say, for me when I was studying this way, way back in the day, that these cathedrals are esoteric masterpieces in stone. Hugo wrote, "From remotest antiquity, the human race has employed architecture as its chief means of writing. Sometimes an entrance, a front, or even an entire church presents a symbolic meaning wholly foreign to religion or even hostile to the church. Only the initiated can decipher these mysterious books." Wow.
Wow, man.
Yeah, that lit a fire under me when I first read it. And I was like, I have to decipher these cathedrals. And I've been working on it ever since.
Wow, yeah. I could literally just reading that through, Dan, that's lit a fire up inside of me. It's so true. It's so true, man. It just... Wow. And
you know, just walking down the street in New York City, I would see symbols and I would say, where did I see that one before? Here's a perfect example. This is on Fifth Avenue. It's now the Coca-Cola Company. And I remember I knew I'd seen that before. Didn't remember. Boom. It was from Pompeii. It's a pagan religious symbol. It's a motif. It's almost exactly the same. And again, the twin serpents,
exactly the same.
Right, yeah, again, the twin serpents, duality. You have the column in the middle. It's aligned with the apex of the triangle. The duality is coming from the twin sides of the triangle, the two lower points of the triangle. It all matches up.
Wow, man, that's exactly the same. Yeah. Like, wow, isn't crazy, it? Man.
Yeah. And again, Europe's ancient swastikas. The idea really is that ancient Europe was Hindu. And if you, I'm not sure, do you know about the history of the Indo-Europeans? And it's a long story, but to cut a long story very, very short. And this is the way I like to explain it. I believe that all of Europe and all of India have a common ancestor. Mm. And the peoples were Hindu. And the Hindus that went into India and the Hindus that went into Europe were essentially the same peoples. And that's why the swastika, which is the key symbol in Hinduism, is found not only in India, but in Europe, in ancient Europe, not only in ancient India, but in ancient Europe. And I say here, Hinduism, with its high spiritual concepts of the eternal soul, reincarnation, karma, yoga, the third eye, and nirvana, is the lost religious tradition of Europe, because I believe it is. It flourished long before Christianity and the Hebrew Bible arose 2,000 years ago and took its place. And this is not a racist conjecture or an unsupported opinion. It's actually a fact grounded in academia. Wow. This is a fact that ancient Europeans were Hindus. They use the swastika just like the peoples in India. This is a kind of a controversial topic because a lot of people use this to try to use, I shouldn't say a lot of people, I should say that historically the concept of the Aryan race has been used as a racial, as a kind of racially charged concept. And they're trying to say that it was the whites who come up with this religion and taught it to the people in India, which I do not believe. I believe, like I said, that the peoples of Europe and the peoples of India have a common ancestor and a common heritage. Mm-hmm. And that's why, and their key symbol was the swastika. And that's why they're called the Indo-Europeans, India, Europe. Mm. And so I believe that that's why the swastika is found not only in ancient India, but in ancient Europe. And I call it censored because why does nobody know about this today? The reason is because the swastika is an incredibly profound, powerful symbol. And if you really know how to use it, it'll empower you.
Yes, I totally agree. It's have you read much into Madame Blavatsky's work?
A long time, but I've read all her books through and through, and this is partly where I've come to, you know, realize what I'm talking about here.
Yeah, because she was discussing that the Aryan race is the fifth root race. Mm-hmm. Of this planet. What do we have here? We all have
this is the Caduceus. This is more in these days, it's more well known that the Caduceus rod is the Sushumna in India. That's called the Sushumna. It's the center point of the triptych, and the twin serpents are the duality in India. They're called Pingala and Ida, the yin and the yang. And the pine cone is symbolic of the pineal gland, which is what they call the third eye. The third eye and the pineal gland. The pineal gland is the material manifestation of the third eye. Mm-hmm. And the idea here is to summon the serpent power to the forehead, and it'll awaken the pineal gland of the third eye.
Yes, that's... Toltecs as well.
Is a good one. A great author, Victor Sanchez, I found this quote and I matched it up to this wall relief from the Toltecs. If you look closely, look at that wall relief. First of all, you could see an awakened third eye on the forehead. Second of all, you could see that face is made up of two people kind of joining faces, but it looks like it's one face looking at us. And that's a symbol of the exact same thing that the triptych is, which is bringing together the two sides of the duality into one unified force. Mm. And so I was fascinated by this picture. And then I came across this quote by Victor Sanchez, and I just put the two together. He says, by denying everything that is outside the boundaries of the rational mind, modern humans have denied half of themselves. The indigenous Toltec people of Mexico didn't make that mistake. They knew they were double beings. They knew that we are double beings. They know about the double nature of the world. That is why they call the world Omeyakan, or the place of duality. I thought that was wonderful.
Yes. Wow. It's a very interesting picture as well.
I know, it's great.
Whereabouts is that based?
You know what? I don't know. I know it's by the Toltecs, but I was never able to actually locate it and find out exactly where it is. And I think it's in Mexico, but I'm not exactly sure.
We got some more triptych temple.
Yeah, Masonic triptych temples. Here's a Thomas Paine quote from Origin of Freemasonry. Thomas Paine, very famous essayist in colonial American history. He says, Masonry is derived from some very ancient religion. At what period of antiquity or in what nation this religion was first established is lost in the labyrinth of unrecorded time. And here I'm just showing the ancient pyramid cultures built triptychs. And we have the same triptychs in modern Masonic architecture, modern Masonic temples.
Wow. And then some more of the yin-yang.
Yin-yang symbol, similar to Chinese. This is a great one. On the right-hand side, you could see, I've been saying that the Aten is the third eye in Egypt. And you could see on the bottom, obviously the Egyptians built pyramids. In the Americas, we have what's called the Zia sun symbol. They're both sun symbols. Like the Aten, the Zia is a sun symbol. And like the Aten, the Zia was depicted in artifacts found in Arkansas, present-day Arkansas, on the forehead. So you could see that artifact in Arkansas is exactly parallel to the artifacts in Egypt, in that they're both using solar emblems in the position of the third eye. And that's to show that they both were awakening their third eye. And of course, on the bottom, under Arkansas, you can see that the peoples of the ancient Americas also built pyramidal structures. They're called mounds, but they're really pyramids. And so there's a tremendous parallel here.
There's going to be a lot of interesting findings to come out of America in the next few decades. I think America is completely misunderstood and the history has been completely distorted. And obviously your Graham Hancock's new book, America Before, which I feel like is just going to open the doors of inquiry to this. Have you heard of, there's a decent channel, Rich, on YouTube called The Phoenix Enigma. Have you heard of that?
I haven't heard of it, but I'm writing it down right now.
It's a researcher who's based out in Phoenix, Arizona, and he says that Arizona, or Phoenix itself, sorry, is one giant megalithic site that's just been built upon, and the town itself is now it's a few levels above the original site. And he says that if you dig deep enough, like people in their back gardens can dig, and they find artifacts, they find like sort of real degraded walls and structural outlines. And he believes that it was the epicenter of some high civilization in around that part of the Americas. Wow. I don't know how long. And they also, there's a researcher called Josh Reeves. Are you familiar with him?
Nope.
He did some research in a place very idly named Stonewall, Texas. And there is this wall that is
I've heard of that wall.
Yeah, it's layered, or it's been unearthed from a layer that is about a layer of earth that they carbon dated to about, I think, 25,000 years ago, and it's a big monolithic wall that's underneath the city. So there's a lot of obviously you've got the mounds, like you said, which are like the points in which we can see without doing any further investigation. But I feel like just as we know that ancient Egypt, the Vedic valleys, Sumer, Mesopotamia, Mesoamerica all go back thousands and thousands of years, I believe that they're going to start to discover that with America as well. As they know, the whole world was inhabited, man. It's like the whole world was Atlantis, and before that there was an even more ancient race, and it dates back hundreds of thousands of years. So it's
fascinating.
Ooh, this is a interesting one. Yo, let's if we talk, just finish up on this one, Rich, and then we'll close up because you literally have 1 minute, 60 okay. seconds.
All right, yeah. So so this is an image. I actually commissioned a New York City street artist to paint this about 20 years ago, because at the time, like I said, I was interested in Egyptology. I still am, but I was focused on it. And what I had found was that in Egypt, the pharaohs were always depicted with what's called the Nimes headdress and the plaited beard. And they also had the shepherd's crook and the flail in their hands. And I wondered what those were. And then one day it kind of, I shouldn't say it dawned on me, but I guess looking at the imagery over and over again, I started to realize that Nimes headdress is actually symbolic of long hair. And the plaited beard is obviously symbolic of a bearded human being. And the shepherd's crook, you know, I am the shepherd. This is a kind of a Christian symbol. So the pharaohs used these vestitures, not just as pharaohs, but when they were mummified. And the reason was because as pharaohs, they were following in the reign of Osiris. And as dead mummies, they were following in the death and resurrection of Osiris. And the idea of death and resurrection is obviously something that we've heard of through Jesus and the whole Christian religion. And although nobody's ever seen Jesus wearing the long hair and the beard, most of the images that have come down to us show him with this long hair and a beard. So I came to realize that in Egypt, the pharaohs were emulating Osiris, emulating the god Osiris, the first king of Egypt, who was a bearded man with long hair. And that's actually what the hieroglyph that forms the name of Osiris, most of the hieroglyphs that form the name Osiris have this image of a bearded man with long hair in them. And so the idea here is to show that all that we know of as Christianity really comes from Egypt. And the Egyptians were the first to depict Osiris, who's the forerunner of Jesus, as this kind of bearded figure with long hair, the shepherd, the good shepherd, the great leader who died and rose from the dead, which of course is a metaphor for our own death and resurrection, the ego death and the resurrection of the soul that needs to occur. But just as a quick nutshell, that's really what this image was trying to show.
Fascinating. Yes. All right, Rich, let's tie this one up. I'd love to have you for longer, and I'm sure there's plenty more images for us to go through. But for now, for everyone that is sat here, listen to this, watch this, whereabouts can they find more of you?
You can find most of my work is on my website, which is richardcassaro.com. And you've seen all all my photos plastered with that. And I apologize for that. I always profusely apologize. I guess I forgot to do it until just now, but most of my work has been shared online and people just don't put the source. And so I realized that too late. And so just a few years ago, I started putting the watermark on my images and I put them everywhere. Now I probably go overboard, but seeing your work shared, not only seeing your work shared, but seeing other people take credit for your work. I don't like that. This is a lifelong thing for me. And I've noticed, especially in the last couple of years, people are fearless. They will come up and say, well, this is my meme. I put this together. No, it's not. It's absolutely not yours. And it's okay. I mean, you know, people want to be, they're putting things on Facebook and they want to share things, but that's fine. But when you take credit for something that's not yours, I think a line can be drawn there. But anyway, richardcassaro.com, that's my website. And if anyone's interested, I have books for sale. And that's pretty much it. I'd love your support. I need support in order to continue in this research. And I love what I do. And it's been a real pleasure here talking to you, Chris. And I appreciate your inviting me on. And I had a great time chatting with you.
Yeah, massively, massively. I totally agree, dude. And guys, woo, fuck, this was a deep one. And hopefully you guys really made the most of the video content and all the imagery on the video. Like, if you're listening to this, then hey, just please just check out the YouTube version as well and just watch the videos. This is going to be one of the more important episodes to actually watch as a video to make the message really hit home about Richard's work. So again, please show Richard some love. Let me know what you thought of this episode. Let Richard know, and we would both be massively appreciative of any feedback we get. And again, this is still scratching the surface. Richard has committed his whole life to this, as have I. And please, any questions that you have regarding this material, reach out to us and we will do our best. Other than that, let's tie shit up. That's episode 56. Over and out. Guys, stay woke as fuck, and I'll catch you on the next episode.